Who are you?
Tim Callender.
Summer Brooks.
Brett Filipek.
We host the Babylon podcast.
What do you want?
To study and discuss the Babylon 5 universe.
Where are you going?
To discover every scrap of B5 memorabilia.
Who do you serve, and who do you trust?
And welcome back to the Babylon Podcast. I am Tim Callender.
And I can't find my phone to call into the show, so I'm just going to be here live for this show.
That's right. Yeah, Gary's cutting out the middleman. He's leaving out the voice message system and coming right on. Yes, Brett is off moving to where I don't know, but he's sort of discombobulated. Summer, we are pleased to say, is employed, but that's also got her on a different schedule, so she is resting, and we're happy for her. But that means that, like I said, we got Gary involved here, and we might be hearing from Jeremy, our wonderful engineer.
Yay, Jeremy!
So we've got a Babcast going here for you folks. I've got a little bit here, something I wanted to share real quick because I was curious about this, and here it is. As we know, one of the myriad projects that JMS has been working on off and on. And of course, now he's got plenty of time since the Lensman project has been shelved.
And the
B5 project, right. Yeah, exactly. This guy doesn't have to do anything. It's all getting shelved. This is the Forbidden Planet.
Wow. And boy, has that been a messed up situation with the script getting leaked. So he had to do another version, and they shelved it after that. So.
Right. And this comes off of the JMS News site. It's a posting that JMS had put up. Somebody had asked him a number of questions. So I pulled this bit out. And JMS writes, to the current disposition of Forbidden Planet, since Cameron had to withdraw to focus all his efforts on Avatar 2, Warner Brothers has started the process of looking for a new director. The hard part is finding someone with enough hardcore effects background and a real knack for characterization, both of which are required to make the script work. They want to get it made. It's a big tentpole movie for them, but it's a matter of finding the right person to make it. So let me just say two things about that. First of all, tentpole makes me giggle like Beavis and Butthead. Okay.
They're hoping it's the next franchise. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is, maybe I'm in the minority, but I guess I'm kind of glad that James Cameron isn't directing this, because I can't say that I've, with the exception of the first Terminator, I haven't been particularly fond of his work.
I can take it or leave it.
I have to agree. His writing has been shallow, I guess. It's not that it's overtly horrible so much as you can see it coming a mile away.
Right. So, you know, I don't know. I know it would be interesting. If you, Gary, you're a knowledgeable sort.
Yes. Thank you. I'll block it. Wow. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Make sure that you spell the name correctly on the check. Who would you like to see direct for a remake of Forbidden Planet?
I don't. You know, there's two different ways you could go. You could go super, you know, super serious, or you could go lighthearted. I can't say I have somebody particularly in mind. And when I say lighthearted, I'm not talking about Jim Carrey or Seth Rogen or anything like that. But I don't know that works as high science fiction, if you want to call it that, like a 2001. I don't see it working that way. I think it could be a sort of – I'm trying to think of a sort of light, not quite Galaxy Quest, but or maybe even in that sort of realm where it's a little tongue-in-cheek and fun and like, oh, crap, what do you mean there's a monster? I don't see him. I know he's invisible. I could see it working. The only part of the Cameron missing out would be – I would have loved to see the machine, you know, that's in the planet pictured by as how he would visualize it. We might pick on Cameron for a lot, but his visuals are incredible, even if his storyline isn't.
Sure. How about you, Jeremy? You got an opinion?
I guess Kubrick's out of the question, huh?
Yeah, without getting timey-wimey.
Right, right.
No, and that also leaves out Orson Welles as well. So
right, right. Well, we could always get Joss Whedon to do it.
Woo! That's interesting.
Well, yeah. Well, somebody does die in the story, so I guess yeah.
Right.
That's
right down
his that's finale. Definitely in his yeah.
All right. Okay. Now, Gary, you have in your possession, as you tell us, not one but two different copies of Pat Tallman's Pleasure Threshold book.
Yes, I do. Thanks to a very close friend of mine who went out to San Diego Comic-Con. She was very nice enough to pick me up a copy of the, I guess you'd call it the preliminary version. And it is a substantially different version. There's more than almost 100-page difference between this preview copy, if you want to call it that, and the final one. I think there were only 50 given out. I'm not trying to toot my horn so much as to try and let some people know that there is much more in the final version than in my preview copy. Dozens upon dozens of extra pictures. What the script team did was, after they put this out, they asked the people who had seen it what they liked, what they didn't like, what they wanted to see more of. And Pat went back and started writing more and pulling out more pictures and really enhanced the book even more. So, wow. You know, by no means should people feel left out by even, you know, feeling, oh, there's a second version. No, the first version is definitely the poor man's version of this book. The final available one is much more complete, much more detailed. As I said, we were in a sense almost like previewers where we looked at it and said, we'd like this, more of this, this, why'd they do that? And they took it all to heart, and Pat, God bless her, went back to work and wrote out a whole bunch more stuff to put into the book to make it worth more, you know, to a fan. And I never realized how much Pat has done in the industry. You know, she's done, besides Babylon 5, of course, we know about, you know, she's done dozens upon dozens of Star Trek episodes in just about, I believe, every series short of Enterprise. She's worked with dozens of other movies, and it's just incredible, her career. And it's not just her career that they talk about. They talk about her life, you know, what it's like to be a person in Hollywood and working on a show. And I don't mean to belittle her by saying it's not from a star's point of view, but you very much feel that, you know, you get a sense of Pat as a person, and you feel her frustrations about having to arrange daycare so she can be on the set at 6 a.m. And you know, that she feels bad as a parent sometimes that, you know, she's got to do that, but it's her job, so she has to. And it's just, you know, her as Pat as a person really comes through. Right. And then they throw in some extra stuff too. I haven't had a chance yet. I'm saving it for this weekend coming up, but they have, I guess you want to call it a outlaw commentary on Secrets of the Soul, where she and JMS sit down and recorded an audio track. So you queue up the video, put in this audio track, and you get a pirate or a different sort of commentary on the episode, which I'm looking forward to greatly. And it's, like I said, it's great. It's not a star vehicle in that sense. It's not like, oh, everything is glamorous and love me, or, you know, because I'm so great. No, Pat really opens up more than she ever really had to, honestly. I'm amazed at the level of intimacy she goes into in the book and opens herself up in a lot of different ways. If you want to see what it's like as a person to be in Babylon 5, I think this is the thing to watch, to read and even watch. There's some videos on the disc that has the commentary as well. We've seen JMS's talks, and if for those listeners who have some of the script books, it's not that he doesn't give a sense of it, but she really, you know, she was on the set filming, not sitting behind a desk typing up the words to be said. And it's a very unique perspective. Just as one example of a comparison to JMS's words, as we well know, for JMS, the infamous Blackpool convention was always considered pretty much a disaster. He was dead exhausted dealing with Claudia's leaving, I guess I will put it.
And, yeah, right. Her departure.
Her departure. Losing his notes for the fifth season and being dog tired and trying to negotiate the fifth season to stay alive and move from, you know, PTN. And so, you know, we always view it for him as an extremely stressful, horrible sort of thing that he managed to barely survive. Pat, on the other hand, had the most magnificent time of her entire life at it. She loved every moment, and we have dozens of pictures of her and the whole rest of the cast smiling and enthusiastic and talking on stage and playing video games. And
right.
It's just very interesting to get another take on something that we've typically only heard one side from.
Right, right. Good point. You know, a couple things that – now, I haven't seen the book, but I will say from – to sort of dovetail on something you mentioned, one of the things that's been very enlightening for me doing the Babylon podcast is interviewing so many of, you know, not only the crew but the cast – with only a few exceptions, they are all what I would characterize as working actors. In other words, they're not stars. They're not big names. They'll take a job because they want to be working, but they might also be doing something else to supplement that income. And yeah, it's a whole different kind of Hollywood than
yes, yeah, exactly. That you don't typically get to see, which
or think about. Yeah,
yeah. It's like, wow, I never thought that you know, you hear about the, oh, I had to be on the set at 4 a.m. for makeup before, you know, even though we didn't start shooting yet. Wait a minute, you have a kid. Who's going to take
Right, right, exactly. What
and
do you
she
do
talks
then?
About, you know, getting them all, you know, ready. And, you know, I was like, wow, I never occurred to me. But absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Oh, no, we've just started a new reality show.
Uh-oh.
After a round through their day.
Yeah. Now here's the other thing that just a completely random thing, but if you remember our interview with Pat Tallman way back in like episode 6.
Yes, something. Yes. I was there, yeah.
She mentioned that she studied with Charles Nelson Reilly.
Yes, as an acting coach, yeah.
Right. And of all things on Weird Al Yankovic's latest album, he has a song titled CNR, which is an ode to Charles Nelson Reilly. And the fact that he ran a road race with just it's all these things about how he unhinged his own jaw in order to eat a motorcycle and how awesome he is. Anyways, I was listening to this song and all I could think of was Pat Tallman going, oh my God, he studied with Charles Nelson Reilly. It's like, wow. Anyway, there's your random thought for the day. So is this book, Gary, is this something that everybody should get a hold of? Do you think? I mean, is this
there's a lot of pictures in here that you've never seen before. I've been a Babylon 5 fan for a long time now, and these aren't all stock pictures that you see. The pictures themselves are new. I can't say there's any huge, incredible revelations per se. There's no smoking guns, but to see what it's like to be on set is part of what the message of this book is. I've listened to interviews and read all the script books and everything like that, but this is the first time I've had a sense of what it was like to be there.
Cool.
Which was really nice. So I'd recommend it. It's, you know, it's $40. It's a good read. Pat's very nice. It's one of those things where I thought nothing but good about Pat to begin with, and I think even more good of her now. She's a great person. You know, not only this is she working her, you know, raising kids. She works for a charity called Be a Santa for the holidays to give toys to, you know, kids who can't afford to get them themselves. You know, she doesn't have to do any of that. So, you know,
right. You
know, like I said, so she's giving, you know, she wants to help other people. She's friendly. I don't know if you follow her Twitter stream, but I do. And she's hilarious, a bit raw at times, humorously so. But yeah, no, she's good people. And it's a good read for any Babylon 5 fan. You won't be disappointed. You won't feel like, oh, geez, I didn't need to get this. I wasted my money. No, you will be happy when you get a hold of it. And as a bonus, it does hold the infamous, what would you like to call it? The middle finger salute by the whole cast.
Nice.
It's a rare picture that goes around. I think typically at the moment, I believe Stephen First is the one who usually signs it and sells it around at conventions. Most of the actors don't. But so it does have that in there, which is a bit of a rare find for somebody to run across. It was during the TV guide shoot at, I believe, the beginning of season 5. And it, you know, it's basically everybody, you know, the whole cast, everybody from, you know, Garibaldi, Jakar, to Lita, to Sheridan, giving the finger to the camera. So it might be worth it.
That's
just
worth
for that
the price of admission right there.
Yeah. I know I had to pay about $20 or $30 for my print when I got it. So that's more than half the price of the book right there.
Very good. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we go ahead and take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with our mystery topic for the night.
I'm Michael R. Menengate.
I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Michael Stackpole.
And I'm Brian Brown.
Join us for an exciting romp through literature and books.
Romp?
We're not romping.
We're supposed to be cool.
That's smooth. Right.
Okay.
It's the cool.
It's the smoothing sounds.
The smoothing sounds.
I don't know, but romp just brings forth images of Michael in tights, and I'm so not going there.
Well, which Michael?
It doesn't matter. Neither one would be very good.
If you would like to join this thing that we do every week, it's called Dragon Page, cover to cover.
Take two. Welcome to Dragon Page, cover to cover, where the elite meet to discuss literature.
Okay, let's go back to the tights images.
Yeah.
Dragon Page, cover to cover, where you'll never know what you're going to get next.
Okay, we are back, and are you gentlemen ready for the mystery topic for tonight?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this is something I've kind of been keeping in my back pocket because I thought it would be an interesting conversation, and I was waiting for us to get into Crusade. So we're gonna have a shootout here. I've got four captains in mind. Compare and contrast. Mm. I'm not even sure I'm going to say that we can figure out who's the best, but these following captains: Sheridan, Gideon, Reynolds, and Kirk.
What do you have against the women captains in Babylon 5? But anyway, go ahead.
Well, me. That's I'd a whole like different have show. Up against the – yeah. Well, okay, never mind. Ba-dum-tsh. We already did the Babylon 5 episode.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, the reason I picked those four is because I think there's a significant overlap in styles – and yet also some very telling differences. And I don't have a particular agenda. I'm not looking for everybody to say one is better. This isn't really necessarily even the Kirk versus Picard argument. But I guess, you know, if I'd thought it out more, should have worked up categories. So let's start with the obvious category. If you are in a firefight, if you're down on a planet and your away team landing party group is pinned down by Drak, Minbari, Klingon, Alliance factions or whatever, who would you want to be calling the shots in that situation? We're on the ground. We've got our weapons out. It looks bad.
In your exact scenario, I'd have to say I'd probably be, Malcolm Reynolds. If you go by that universe's sort of rules, so to speak, I think that's your person to have the best chance to get off planet.
Yeah, to survive, yes. I would have to agree with that totally.
But I don't know how much that is
But he's alive.
Okay.
Of course, everybody that was around him almost died, so maybe that's not the best choice.
Well, I mean, and to be fair, part of the reason they lost is they didn't get the air support that they were looking for in an untenable situation.
Well, what it comes down to, too, is, you know, he was, in a sense, the most free in his actions. You know, as you look at even a Kirk who's sort of out on the space frontier, he had a little bit of accountability. But, you know, as you go up this scale where Reynolds would be the least, you know, Kirk would be the next up, probably Gideon after that. And then Sheridan, you know, pretty much, you know, what are you doing out there? Oh, crap. Run the diagnostic. You know, he was immediately accountable. So, you know, there's different levels of how you have your hands tied and how you can respond to a situation. I think Sheridan had to always come up with almost, in a sense, the more creative or the smarter solution because of that hamstringing.
As opposed to Kirk just cheating?
Yeah, well, that and, you know,
the Kobayashi Maru.
By the time he would get back to his superiors in Starfleet, the bulk of the situation would typically be resolved. So Starfleet would just care about endings. Reynolds, it was just his ending. you know, Gideon was really had a sole purpose, so, you know, they would look a little bit left and right as long as he was staying on his, you know, crusade. And but Sheridan, no, he was getting second guessed all the time, getting advisors sent to, you know, political advisors sent to him, you know, generals telling him what to do, home guard telling him what to do, night watch telling him what to do. He was
the Len telling him what to do.
Yeah. And that's the one that really counts.
Yeah,
right.
But he was constantly getting, you know, second guessed, being told, you know, having his options limited, yet still succeeding so very well that, you know, I guess in a firefight, I would like him, if we can open up your scenario just a little bit larger, I guess.
Okay. All right. Because, see, I'm also thinking that different from a space battle.
Okay.
You know, I mean,
just a ground.
Yeah, this is a ground situation. You're on a planet.
Essentially,
you've got
2D.
Right, exactly. Like I said, you've got your landing party / away team / crewmates or what have you.
Well, if you want to assume for the sake of keeping everything level that I'm not wearing red, I would still
– Yes.
I think you'd have a pretty good shot with Gideon. He doesn't mind bending the rules to, you know, achieve what he needs to do.
Right.
And it's not just about him. So.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take it off world and let's put it into the three-dimensional realm of space. And if you were let's not look at grand strategy. Let's look ship to ship or even small fleet actions. Cause I think all these, well, you know, not so much Reynolds, but who would you want calling the shots in space?
Well, I don't think you can not say Reynolds, you know, given how, you know, at the end of, you know, Serenity, how he sort of basically ran the one fleet into the other fleet. That is a tactic after, you know, a certain sense of the term. So I wouldn't discount him entirely. But we never really saw much in the line of Kirk with space battles. So that's kind of hard to say. Sheridan, we've seen the most with. So I'd have to go with him, even barring a nuclear device. I think he's still, you know, as if it's a reasonable matchup, he usually succeeds.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that because the one thing about Kirk and I have a great admiration for the character of Kirk and I'll get to a bit about why he's the most difficult of all these in a moment. But in Wrath of Khan, there's even that moment at toward the end as they are going through the Mutara Nebula where Spock has to remind him, Captain, we're in three-dimensional space. And Kirk goes, oh, yeah, you're right. And then he's behaving like he's flying a spaceship or in charge of a spaceship. So, you know, but to be fair, I'm with you. I think out of all of them, Sheridan is the one that we see most with a variety of tactics, not only ship to ship. And you think about Matters of Honor, where he takes out the shadow vessel by opening up a jump point within a jump gate. But you also see it as he's commanding the White Star fleets and the assault on Earth and dealing with a whole host of different races and trying to knit them together into a fighting force when they're fighting shadow vessels and trying to end the shadow war. So, and also he's the one that seems most willing to not even think outside the box, but crumple the box up into a little ball and toss it aside.
I think situational awareness is his key.
Oh, good. Yeah, good point. Precisely.
Good phrase. Definitely. Yeah. That's a succinct way to put it.
Right. Okay. Here's the next comments. Okay. So I think we all agree that Sheridan is definitely the guy you want running your fleet. Now here's one.
Except Gideon does have that big gun. But,
yeah, he does. You're right about that.
Yeah, but he doesn't have the beard and the naval cap to go along. Oh wait, sorry. That's the Yamato. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a little outside the realm of our thing here. Now we're gonna go in a dizzying display. We've gone from space, we've gone to ground combat with units. Now, who would you like to have at your back in a bar brawl?
A brawl? I'd say Kirk. Reynolds always seems to have to pull a gun to stop a fight.
yeah, okay.
Sheridan, I don't know how hand-to-hand proficient that man actually is.
You know, when he got tranked, he went down fighting, so you gotta take that into account. I mean, he really did.
He was fighting
all the way, and there was a bunch of them.
Yep. But on the other hand, Kirk has the move where he boxes the ears and then doubles
and
up the
double
fist
axe
to the
handle.
Back.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's it.
Right, exactly. And he rips his shirt. You know,
that's to distract the enemy.
Oh, wait, are we counting style points? Do style points count on this? Because, you know, that's a whole different factor.
Well, you know, it's a style of fighting. So yeah, at least in the barroom brawl, style points absolutely have to count. I think definitely James T. Kirk wins on that.
Wait, it's okay for somebody to pinch somebody's neck and collapse him, but when he does a double karate chop, you're picking on the man.
I'm not picking on him. I want okay. That's what I want. I want him to.
No, that's his move. It's his special move.
Right. I love or the hand to the face. You know where they're in that hug and he puts the hand up against the guy's face. Yeah. You know, and then he does the double neck chop thing, and yeah. What's the move? I love the move in Journey to Babel where he's fighting the Orion guy who's disguising Andorian, and he like jumps up against the wall and then does the body drop on him.
Yeah,
it's like I'm not even sure what that was all about. That was just like I'm the captain and I'm going to do this. It was very strange. All right, and I would agree. You know, Jeremy, I hear what you're saying about Sheridan, the fact that he put up a big fight when he was tranked, but we don't ever really see him in a fight. And that leads me to
– just a straight-out fight, even odds. Yeah,
I mean,
really see
Kosh was beating the heck out of him in that hallway.
You know, and see it.
The brawl in the hall, yeah.
Right, but here, see, that leads into my next category. Who would you like to have in a barroom situation that you don't want to get into a fight And who do you want there to help get you out of that fight?
Because preempt the fight, stop the fight before
right,
it starts.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or not even so much preempt it, but make it clear that you don't want to get into a fight. See, in my mind, that's where Sheridan shines. You think about, and now see the episode title escapes me, but it's the episode where they're facing off with the dock workers.
Oh, Sheridan with the gun down in the pocket?
Yeah, and yeah. He takes the axe handle or whatever it is, the club from the guy, and puts the PPG in the guy's pocket and says, okay.
Right. I got what I got.
Yeah, right. Come on. You and me. Let's do it. And I think even the brawl in the hall, that isn't – well, I say it's, you know, he's not going to go toe-to-toe, mano-a-mano or mano-a-Vorlon with Kosh. But it is more – he's not being aggressive in the sense of, you know, I'm going to best you. He just basically shows up Kosh and says, okay, look, here's the deal. You know, do this or don't. But – you know, and he's even willing to allow himself to die to make his point.
You have a good point.
So,
I don't know. I don't think he's conniving enough sometimes to get out of a situation as much as Gideon might be able to.
Okay.
I think Gideon could almost befriend the opposite force, or at least, you know, talk him into maybe you'd rather beat that guy up next door or something.
Yeah, he has
along
a very,
those lines.
A very
yeah.
high charisma. He has.
Right. Right.
So
I would really love to have seen Value Judgments, the unproduced script that features Bester, because I would love to have seen the gambling scene where Gideon basically gambles to get access to the colony. Because that's just so – I mean, it's so Gideon, obviously, but that's such against – type in this genre. You either have the captain like Sheridan would be someone who would appeal to their higher natures. Okay? Reynolds, he's at that level, so he just blend in. You know, he just saunter in. He looks like just one of the other guys, so it's never an issue. Gideon is like, I may look like I have authority, but I'm not going to throw it around because I'd much rather take your money. You know, and that I wish we could have seen much more of that. You know,
yeah,
that would have been
excellent to see that part of his character development, because he does have that feel to him.
Yeah, yeah, and that's part of the danger. He wants those high stakes. You know, in Racing the Night, that's the thing in the open is the Earth Force. Generals are like, we can't believe that you are gambling, you know, the lives of Earth a year ahead of quote unquote schedule just to get access from all the various races to go do what you need to do. And, yep. You know, that is so against genre type that I really wish we could have seen more of that. So maybe Gideon's the guy that you want there in a situation that could turn chippy.
Well, if I think he'd be my best bet to get out of the back door before it got bad. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
A distraction, if nothing else.
Right. Right. Okay. So going from that, from that, how about just general diplomacy? If you're in a situation where and not so much trying to get out of a tough jam, but you're going in and saying, look, here's why we all need to work together. Who do you think takes that?
Well, I just want to preempt that by automatically jumping up and saying, I don't know that Sheridan's exactly the right answer for this. I can recall many times with the League of Non-Aligned Worlds where he couldn't get it done. He had to resort to some trick, whether it was nothing happened in that sector,
right?
Or sending, almost not telling them, and so that they would, band together and things of that nature. So his own diplomacy didn't necessarily pull that together, and I don't consider setting them up to necessarily be diplomacy.
Oh, okay, because I was going to say, is that necessarily a bad thing to use deception? If it brings people together on to a common cause, is that a bad thing?
To some extent, no. But I mean, you know, there's a difference between, you know, information in words and information in action, which is sort of what I had viewed that as. That could have easily have blown up in his face.
Sure.
As opposed to trying to persuade somebody by, you know, reiterating points or just not mentioning a point per se, or, you know, of contention, trying to agree, find some common ground verbally versus basically, in a sense, make something up that could have been disproved, or, you know.
Basically, you're lying.
Yeah, very much so. And it's not a lie of omission it's, you know, it's literally fabrication. So
I'm reminded of the quote, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but Lanier says something somewhere around the beginning of the third season about how if you have the coffee cup.
Yes. if you do the right thing for the wrong reason.
If you're trying to do the right thing, but your methods are flawed, then that flaw
the work is corrupted or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, go get your coffee mug, dude.
It's in the dishwasher. I keep them up in the cabinet ever since my kid read the Ivanova quote. You know, it stays up there.
Yeah.
I try to have that one early in the morning. When
yeah, right.
But it's not that hasn't shown skill of it, but it just I wouldn't call him the slam dunk immediate choice that we might normally want him to be.
Sure. So at that point, I mean, I don't think Gideon's that guy. Gideon would much rather play cards for whatever he's after than to make nice to get what he's after. In fact, we see quite often when he's trying to make nice, it just kind of blows up in his face, but it just goes nowhere.
Yeah.
You know,
I'd actually lean towards Reynolds. Yeah.
His style of negotiation is very blunt and it usually involves bullets.
Well, no, you say that, but it's not usually him starting the shooting. So,
well, that's true.
Well, as David Sheridan said, you know, never start a fight, but be prepared to finish it.
Yeah. So I'd lean towards him.
It's interesting that we say all this, and you'd almost say by default that leaves Kirk as the guy that brings them all to, you know, has the ability to use charisma and rhetoric to bring people together. And there are many instances where he does that, but it tends to be more amongst his own crew than necessarily alien races or other governments. You know, he tends to have to.
Well, he tends to have to destroy the computer, and then all of a sudden the people like him. Yes.
Where, you know, he basically blows up the computers that keep tabulation on the computer generated casualty lists.
Yes.
And basically,
again, he's cheating.
You know, okay. Yeah. Look. Okay. You know, here's your choice. You can either like blow each other up, or he can make nice. It's your choice. You know, and a number of other instances where he basically, you know, has to kind of shove the potential of violence into someone's face before that gets them to say, yeah, maybe we should play nice. So when all said and done, if you just needed a diplomatic situation, who would you call?
I still say Malcolm Reynolds for my vote, sir.
I'm going to have to go with Sheridan. I just think he has too many different ways to approach it.
Oh, hey, that's as valid as anything else we're throwing around here. It definitely is. So,
okay. All right, now here comes the next. This is the related to diplomacy, and this is why I stuck with this particular gender. Who'd you want as your wingman in the bar to pick up hot alien chicks?
I'd still have to go with Kirk given his track record. Sheridan is
Wait a minute, though.
Sheridan just pines after Anna too much. So, you know, it's he finally got to lend to, you know, fill the void, but he was never, you know, hustling around. After all, when that political liaison came over, he wasn't exactly willing to go where no man had gone before, even though he very easily could have.
Yes.
It's so cool. I don't see him. I don't see him picking up the ugly chick that's with the nice one at the bar for me.
Right. Okay. Jeremy, what were you about to say?
I don't know. I'd be afraid Kirk could just take her home, and, you know, he's been with all the blue ladies. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. He might just muscle in on the one that you're angling for.
Right. I don't know. Personally, I just see Gideon would be a good wingman.
Yeah, I could see that. Reynolds also, he's holding out a flame for Inara, so it's not
right,
like
right, so that would make him the perfect wingman, because he's, you know, he's not interested.
Well, okay, yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. And he's charismatic enough to make it interesting.
Exactly.
I like that. That's not a bad choice. That's not a bad choice. All right, so you're in the space bar, you're at a starbase or whatever, and you have struck out. Who do you want to get drunk with?
Gideon. Well, I think I'd have the best stories.
Oh yeah, who would have the best stories? That one's completely up for grabs. I think all four of these captains would have very interesting stories.
Yeah, you probably couldn't go wrong.
Oh yeah, I mean, if I was stuck in a lifeboat / space pod / anything, you know, for like for like a day or two. Oh yeah, any one of them would be probably well worth, you know, being stuck with to you know, chew the fat with. I don't think any of them are uppity or, you know, just shut up and wait till somebody saves
right,
us. You know,
right, right. Or would run out of stories to tell.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think if anything, yeah, see, I was going to say the one I'd least like to share a pod with might be Gideon. If only because he plays it so close to the vest, I'm not sure. You know, at some point, I suspect you'll end up hearing pretty much variations on the same tale, depending upon how long you're trapped in that life pod.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, it's not always, you know, zipped and fastened, so yeah, you have to you know, there are other topics that might come up from time to time, so
right which leg do you put in your pants first? I'm not having this conversation. yes All right, then. Okay, now here finally, who would you most like to have go talk to the bosses for you when the project goes wrong?
Sheridan just popped into my head right away. I think he, you know, he would, you know, lay it out well enough where what's ever going to happen to you is going to happen to you. I'm assuming that the bosses aren't the type that are necessarily going to be sweet talked, but if we had to defuse a situation, I think he would do it best.
I would concur with that.
I would think he would do it with the least amount of fallout, because Kirk could get it done, but you might not like the way it ends up.
Yeah, you might be back in charge of your own ship again.
Right. Well, maybe that's good. Maybe that's bad.
Yeah, one of the many reasons I have problems with that movie, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah, I agree. I think Sheridan is the guy who would lay it out for the bosses. He wouldn't try to sugarcoat it, but he would also point out why decisions were made the way they were made, and there you go. Gideon, you know, no, he reminds me of, I'll tell you who, Gideon reminds me of a guy I worked for. He was an ad manager I worked with early on in my career. And this guy, we'll call him John. John was a great guy to work for, but you would never want him working for you. he would go to bat for his employees. You could always trust him to look out for you. But listening to how he talked to his superiors, it's like, oh my God, the guy was the most gigantic a-hole to anybody who had a title higher than his. And so it's the kind of thing – it ended up backfiring him on him eventually. You know, it's that kind of thing. And I think Gideon is that kind of guy. I think at some point he will piss off the wrong person.
Well, he's got that permanent chip.
I'd say everybody.
No, you're right, Jeremy. He's got the permanent chip on his shoulder. But he also, you know, there's an arrogance there that's like, look, we're going to do it my way. You picked me to do it, so get out of my way because this is how I'm going to do it. And if you don't like it, you shouldn't have picked me in the first place. So, yeah, I don't know that I'd want him going to tell the boss why the presentation wasn't done on time. Kirk, I don't know. Kirk's sort of a wild card in that one. Kirk wouldn't end up going in front of the bosses. He'd go off and save the universe, and then that would get him off the
hook. And then they wouldn't care at that point. We'll let it slide this time.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. He would solve the bigger problem. Yeah. Yeah. So. Okay, well I'll say one thing about all this that as we were talking about this occurred to me that the biggest problem I have with trying to figure out what to do with the character of Kirk is that that character was written by so many different writers that in many ways who writes the characters depends upon what his response is going to be to any given situation.
Right, he's an amalgam.
Precisely. There's a great book called Boarding the Enterprise. It's one of the PopSmart books. The same people that did the Battlestar Galactica book that Summer wrote a piece for. And one of the analysis in there is that, you know, the problem with trying to get a hold of the handle of the character of Kirk is that he was written by so many different people, and they point out that Gene Roddenberry in many ways has sort of a right-wing writer. Now I'm using this as a way to highlight differences, not as a, you know, trying to make a political comment. Whereas Gene Kuhn, when he wrote the character, was much more a left of center. Mm. And so as such, you know, and they pointed to like Gene Roddenberry's Omega Glory as, you know, we're defeating the evil communists is basically that story. Whereas Gene Kuhn's Spectre of the Gun is interpreted as sort of an anti-Vietnam, anti-cowboy diplomacy piece. It's an interesting read, but that's the thing, you know, with Sheridan, because it's primarily written by J. Michael Straczynski, you know what the character is because he knows what the character is. You know,
and you know that character inside and out. I mean, you really
precisely do. Precisely. Same thing with Malcolm Reynolds. You know, primarily written by Joss Whedon, and you know what that character is. And there's and even though there's sort of a mystery to him, in the end he's not that mysterious a character. He's a plain spoken frontier cowboy, which of course is sort of the theme to the whole thing, cowboys in space. But you know, he's
more about conviction.
Right, exactly. He won't follow the law, but he's gonna do the right thing. And that's that character. You never quite know what it's going to be with Kirk. You know, that's going to depend upon, you know, what the situation is. Again, who the writer is, that sort of thing. So, you know, in some of this, it's sort of hard to say who you want. You know, it's hard to say what his reaction is going to be in any given situation.
Right. Well, that also means you could really never go wrong with Kirk.
Right.
I mean, well, seriously, because you know he has a way to respond to every situation that could be different than the last time.
Right. Yep. But by the same token, you know, Sheridan of all these people, he's the one who was most able to adapt from one way of thinking, the military man, to a almost antithetical way of thinking, which is the politician. And while we see in Babylon 5 as that unfolds, that's a great deal of difficulty for him. The fact of the matter is that he embraces that role and rises to that challenge.
He was the right man to do it.
Right, precisely. and, you know, stays with his conviction even when he realizes the right thing to do is the painful thing to do. And I'm thinking of, you know, in that great scene in All My Dreams Torn Asunder where he, you know, basically damns the council for
making him tax him for every friend. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And, you know, most of all, damning me for agreeing to this.
Well, it reminds me of what number one said, you know, it was so much easier when I could just shoot him.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. When things are a little more black and white, it's easier to navigate that. Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. So, all right, guys, you have any further thoughts on our captain? It's not even a SmackDown. It's just more of a comparison of styles. Yeah. And like I said, I wasn't looking for one to win out on any other. I thought it was just very interesting to kind of compare and contrast.
Well, it's interesting that each has their different style. And like you said, you know, with Kirk, he's kind of fuzzy. You know, he kind of fits a little over here and he fits a little over there. But Malcolm Reynolds is always going to be my number one because, you know, I'm a brown coat. So I have to put that disclaimer out there right now.
There you go.
Well, they're all successful within their universes, within their little criteria, so to speak. Right. They're, you know, they're, as you were saying earlier, they're the right men in the right place at the right time. They're, you know, where they work for what they are and they're successful, you shift things around and they might not be.
Well, I think Malcolm Reynolds is probably the one who would be least able to adapt to a different universe. You know, and I think, to be fair, and that's not a slam against him. I think that's in a sense kind of the theme in what little Firefly we got was that, you know, he fought for freedom from the oppression of the inner worlds that failed, and so now he lives on the fringes of society because that's the only place he can fit in, is the outside. You know, so putting him into a situation where he would have to manage something like the Shadow War, it wouldn't work for him because the waters are too treacherous for him to navigate.
Nearly didn't work for Sheridan either. Comfortably walking through that whole scenario.
Well, but you know, he managed to make it work. The thing is that he was able to look at it and he was able to say, okay, you know, look, the only way I can make this happen right now is to manipulate the situation. Ivanova put out a story that nothing happened. You know, and that's how he was able to make it work. And maybe it wasn't well or good or pretty, but it happened. You know, he could navigate that. I think by the same token, Kirk could probably make it work, but I think he'd be least comfortable with it. And I think we see that as that character gets older and, you know, don't let him kick you upstairs. Always stay in the center seat where you can make a difference, you know?
Yeah, well, I don't think Malcolm would want to go up any. If you know, if it had went the other way, I don't think he would have wanted to go up in the ranks that far. He wouldn't have wanted that responsibility.
Right, right. Right, and I think at that in that sense, Gideon sort of inhabits the middle ground and all that. I get the sense that while he takes his responsibility as captain seriously, and while I think he does recognize on an intellectual level the concept of the greater good, in other words, he is an Earth Force officer, he does have to conform to certain rules and regulations, et cetera, et cetera. I also, and especially in light of some of the you know, stuff we've been reading in the Crusade books that have been put out, it is as much a means to an end to avenge the death of his shipmates on the Cerberus, sorry, Garen, not the Aardvark, but the three-headed dog. And so if it gets him closer to that goal, then yes, he'll rise to position of ship's captain and he'll play the game because, again, it's kind of gambling. He'll play the game if it gets him to that point. But I also don't think, you know, he won't rise any higher because he can't play, you know, he won't do what's necessary to become, you know, rear admiral or president of the Interstellar Alliance, despite the fact that he says, I guess that's why I never quite buy that he thinks that line that Sheridan is his hero. I don't know.
Well, you don't have to appreciate every aspect of someone to have them be your hero, so I don't
know. Well, that's a good point. All right, guys, any other thoughts?
No, I think we've, you know, went through this pretty well, you know, given the strengths of each one, what we liked and didn't like, so.
Yep. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get some voicemail and emails on that, too, so. All right, so why don't we take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll close this thing out.
Sounds good.
Let's go.
Hi, this is Kevin Batchelder. And this is the Saturday B-Movie Reel.
Newsom, shoot it! Shoot it!
That's about describes it, yeah.
All right, everybody stay here.
We look specifically at the Sci-Fi Channel's original movies. You know the ones. The ones that air on Saturday night.
Be known throughout the ages as an instant classic.
We need a bigger gator!
Limb cutting, yes. And blood squirting from...
Flying limbs, I called it in my notes.
What could go wrong?
We look on a regular basis at the movies as they come out, and since there have been over 200 of them, we do go back and look at many of them that are now out on DVD. By this point, I had completely forgotten any semblance of seeing if this actually makes any sense from a plot point of view. So come on by, get involved, and have some fun.
Check us out at SaturdayBMovieReel.com.
Our future depends on it. Make it safe.
All right, we're back to wrap this thing up. First of all, before we do that, just want to say thanks to Gary for filling in tonight. We really appreciate you logging into Skype and saying, hey, what's going on?
No problem. My voice hasn't been on the show lately, and I feel remiss for not doing so. So I'm trying to make up.
Right. So all you people who missed Gary on the feedback of Paloozas, there you go. Now you've got it back. Hey, I was at a local Richmond Comic Con a month or so back. And just kind of poking around. I've got a friend who's involved in that, so I was helping him out. But so I was looking at different dealers, and there was a guy who had some Babylon 5 collectibles that I had never seen before. Not that I've really dug into it the same way like you, Gary, have or Summer. But what they were, in essence, trading cards, but paired up with a scrap of fabric from the costume of the various characters. So it was a piece of, with a Jakar trading card, it was a piece of Jakar's costume. There was a piece of President Sheridan's wardrobe.
Were those the Rittenhouse ones, the Rittenhouse cards?
I have no idea what they were. I mean, I was poking through this guy's stuff, and I was like, and I want to say some of these were autographed as well. You know, there was a Box Lehner autograph, and I want to say a Katsulas autograph on these things, but I've never seen the scrap of fabric was encased in a little plastic container with a hole where you could kind of reach in and touch it if you wanted to or something.
Yes, they've done most notably for Babylon 5 as well as Star Trek. Also, it's been done for, and I'm not sure what other series, but I know it had been a common practice for a while. I had gone to a interview panel one time with Jerry Doyle, and he sort of comments on it and berates it. You know, they take my shirt and they cut it up into like a million pieces and tack it on the cards. And, you know, he didn't think much of that. He's like, you know, why not sell it as a shirt to somebody who's going to appreciate it? Now it's just a little tiny square. What does that really mean to anybody? So,
right.
So he made his feelings that he just thought it was idiotic, honestly. But at the same time, there, you know, for many people, that is as close as you will possibly come to your degree of separation away from the show. So I can understand the want and need for somebody to like something like that. I've never been a card collector in that sense of the term. But, you know, but I know many that are. And like I said, they do prize that it's a piece of the show that they can own for less than, you know, $1,000 or something like that. So,
yeah. Yeah, I don't remember what the price was on those because, frankly, knowing that I can't buy it, I don't ever really look to see what the
– I didn't think they typically don't have a ridiculous resale value. It's probably in the tens of dollars, I would think.
Yeah, so there you go. So that's my little encounter there.
And it's a lot cheaper than buying. The last time I saw a Babylon 5 uniform, I think was a Sheridan uniform, yeah. And I think starting bid was well over $1,000. So yeah, so that is a lot cheaper.
Wow.
Yeah,
I would think so for a Sheridan. Yeah,
he's not my size, so I didn't bid that.
is Delaney your size?
No, I'm still waiting for the Vorlon. I figure I could squeeze into that thing. Maybe not the helmet from what Jeffrey says in a small head, but I'm sure I could get those shoulder pads on.
Yeah, right. I know. It's not particularly form-fitting. I think it's a very forgiving outfit there.
But no, those card collectors are, you know, it's really, you know, it's a nice thing. And if you think about it, pre-internet where we could have, you know, gigabyte, you know, or at least several megabyte pictures delivered to our desktop. For a long time, that was the only way to get decent, high quality, you know, pictures at a reasonable price for most people. So no, I mean, I think it's starting to become a bit of a legacy type item. Of course, I'm not counting the age itself, that, you know, card collecting, because you couldn't get the images or see them otherwise. So, it, you know, no, it's nice, and there are people that, you know, collect the individual ones. I still see full sheets go around at conventions from time to time, but definitely those little uniform squares are unique collectible.
Very good. All right. Any final thoughts?
I just wanted to comment a little bit on the fact that this whole Babylon 5 project fell through that JMS was talking about. And more importantly, I have to imagine that he had some rough story ideas or outline. He's not one to just, you know, just literally come up with things on the fly. I imagine he's got some clue of where the story, where he wanted the story to go. So I'm wondering if he'll ever share that with us. I'm not expecting a book or anything like that. Perhaps maybe just as a series of tweets or something on his Facebook page of what his ideas were for the universe or where it was going to start. But I feel like he was just about ready to sink into a whole show. He must have had an outline, and I'd like to see it.
Yeah. I'm with you there. If from what he's saying that it got to the point that they were talking numbers, which translates out to finances, he knew what he wanted to do with that in some significant way, maybe not down to every single word or detail, but enough to be able to start doing stuff.
Maybe he should just go ahead and do it as a radio show.
Whatever, something. Yes.
No, well, what he's referring to is James, some of JMS's tweets. He'll pick a song and put up a link like he's doing a almost like a college radio show, I guess.
Yeah. I was looking at his tweet thing tonight. Again, I'm not a tweeter, so it was kind of, in some ways, reading through all the tweets you'd posted was kind of like hearing just one side of a conversation. You know, in some cases, I could kind of figure out where he was.
You can click around depending. I think if you go to his actual page or something along those lines, and you can actually see both sides that he's, you know, the people he's responding to as well. I know Twitter can seem one-sided from time to time, but if you do hunt around, you can find the actual detail.
Okay.
But I would recommend to everyone, even if you're not a big Facebook fan, he throws up a whole bunch of stuff on his Facebook page. It's most of it's fun and hilarious, and no, it's not all B5 related, but it's still enjoyable fare, and the B5 content does pop up from time to time.
There we go. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it then for tonight's Babylon podcast. As always, you can check us out on the forums, which are over – where are they, Gary?
The forums are at farpointforums.com. There's a folder for the Babylon podcast, and you can definitely go ahead and use it. It's been a little quiet over there lately, but – you know, it only takes one click to start a topic.
So there you go. There's a bunch of other things that Summer normally says that I just wait. Go ahead.
Yes. So besides that, you can email us at.
He knows. Go.
At BabylonPodcast@gmail.com.
There you go.
You can also leave us voicemail on our voicemail line.
Yes.
Area code 206-338-2259. That's 206-338 2259.
That's the year that Geary helped out getting the show done, because otherwise we'd have to call it another mulligan.
Hooray! Yeah. Long live the Alliance.
Yes, and so we'll see you on the other side of the gate, and hopefully Summer, as she's employed, gets settled into her regular schedule.